It's obvious that very few people start at a salary sufficient enough to pay $2,000 a month out of their pocket for their necessary services. So the loss, the potential loss of Medicaid is a very substantial barrier to overcome. Thanks to the Balanced Budget Act of 1997, Oregon was able to create the Employed Persons with Disability Program, which can offer Medicaid insurance to people with persons with disabilities who are working. Requirements are you must have the disability that meets the definition of disabled under Social Security Administration, but the same definition they use for Social Security Disability Insurance and SSI. The other requirement is you must be employed. So to take advantage of this program, the only benefit of which is Medicaid coverage, you must be working, which is a quite a departure for all the programs of the state which now offer. So we now offer, when a person goes to work, a continuance of their Medicaid, so they need not fear that terrific loss of that benefit. So the program started February 1st of this year. We put it running in less than a year, which is really extraordinary. And to this, as of this morning, we had 46 people on the program. So this new program is benefiting 46 people, and we're putting more on every week. Any questions?
Other questions? Representative Rice.
Madam Chair, maybe they're about to get to this. I'd be interested in what the $2 million is going to cover and what will be the activities that covers in the upcoming program.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Ross, that is the next place. On page 83, you have a description of the employment initiative, and it goes on to page 84. It's a proposal for a $2 million general fund package matched with $3.8 million of federal funds. What we intend to do, really, is the same type of thing that we've done in the pilot projects, except with, number one, with a very different population, really needing much more intensive services than the people that we worked with in the pilot project. Because, I think mainly because these are generally people who have a greater degree of barriers. And really it's the personal assistance care, which I think you heard somewhat about during public testimony, that attracting and retaining good caregivers is an issue. And in fact, for this population, makes it a little more difficult. And I think that, quite candidly, when someone, a potential employer sees someone in a motorized wheelchair, it's a little bit different than someone who sort of doesn't have to use a wheelchair, walks into a workplace. And the presentation is different. And I think the employer reluctance, becomes greater when they see what they think may be greater challenges.
Representative Loken. Thank you. I have a question because now we have, you know, the qualified rehabilitation facilities. Now they are supposed to be providing employment and incentives.
They are, in fact, Madam Chair, Representative Loken. This is for people to actually go into what we call competitive employment. These are for people to actually be in the same workplace as people who are able-bodied.
Okay. All right.
So they will be, as opposed to sort of in a distinct facility.
Right.
This will be people working in a workplace with everybody else.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. And the types of services and the types of things that we will do are listed out on page 84. We will do an intensive needs assessment with individuals to help them not only negotiate their social service needs, but also their employment needs. We'll provide for and arrange for job skills training. We'll assist clients, obviously, with finding work, job opportunities. We'll help clients arrange for any personal care or medical care as necessary. To coordinate services with different Department of Human Resources divisions, we anticipate clients in the mental health division, in addition to clients from the developmental disabilities services division, and also we expect, of course, clients of FDSD to also participate. It's a joint partnership with Vocational Rehabilitation Division. We're going to basically be working with joint clients. It's a partnership which we've really started and really formalized, I believe, during the past 2 years with our pilot projects. So, in fact, you'll have a VRD counselor and an FDSD case manager working together in tandem to be able to address those needs. Quite candidly, Vocational Rehabilitation Division is set up. It's a federal program that's very much geared, and it's even more recently been geared to placement activities, so that they're working with clients who are 2 to 3 months prior to employment. What we see is we have a population who has lots of barriers, which we need to spend an amount of time to be able to work through. They're not, most of them, 60 to 90 days prior to employment. They may be a year or two prior to employment. But we believe that there are lots of people who can go to work. We know that people want to be able to go to work, to be taxpayers, and we believe that if we work with them over a period of time with proper planning, with proper counseling, they're going to get there.
Senator Wilson, question. One of the confusing things that has come up through the QRF is the description of disability. Who is a disabled person? And I know there is and I can't quote it, but there is a statute on this, but there is a statute that tells us what disabled means. And there's been some thought that the truly disabled are sometimes perhaps not getting as much work as those that are perhaps could work someplace else. And I just wondered how that particular thing would not apply in this situation, but how would you...
Madam Chair, Representative Loken, really, it doesn't. It doesn't apply, but in fact, what we're seeing is that in fact, if you have a system that is driven by wanting to make a certain amount of placement in competitive employment, which we believe this is where the Vocational Rehabilitation Division is because of a federal program that they work with. What happens is that even though their intent is to work with people who are more impaired and who need more help, in fact, people who need more help don't get the help because I have to spend more time and more effort. And I know there's a big balancing act, which they do at VRD, but in fact, they even can't serve the numbers of people who want to be able to go to work.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is that I believe, and this is, you know, anecdotally, we hear this all the time, is that people who have major barriers are ones who end up being discouraged from the employment market. And that's, we believe, is a real opportunity for us to be able to work with them, because today what we do is we help them with their activities of daily living. So as we help them stabilize their lives, we can also talk with them about employment and help them move really in some cases, at a much slower pace.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm hopeful that that would be the emphasis of this type of program, is to really help those that there's no question they're disabled and target those people.
Well, again, Madam Chair, Representative Loken, especially the program that Scott referenced, the Employed Persons with Disabilities, this is really geared to people who have high-cost personal assistance services or high-cost pharmaceutical drugs that they need to be able to sustain themselves.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How do you do your triage with limited dollars and services that you can offer? Do you say, okay, here are people that are most likely that could find jobs with assistance here's someone who's relatively young and could have a 30-year productive life versus someone who's maybe 60. What's your process as you make those decisions?
Senator Cube-Tubb, Senator Bryant, this is a challenge for us because we haven't had to face that quite as much in our pilot projects because we have, because of the fact that it's been a new project and the fact that with only pilot nature, what we were doing really is we were taking everybody who wanted to participate. I think that we will have to have such a system. We hope we don't get there quickly. But we want to be able to take a variety of people regardless of where they are. Some people, I mean, I think the essence is you start with the assessment and you start with a plan and you check in with people. And there will be a time at which we'll have to say, you know, we can't take any more people because we're overloaded. I just hope that because people will be at different places in the process, that some will need more intensive services at some time and some will need less intensive services. So that at this point, I don't think that we will get to the point within this program over the next biennium at this funding level, we will not get to the place where we'll have to do a lot of triaging.
Madam Chair, just one follow-up. Okay. And I'm not familiar with the laws of discrimination in this area, and I don't want you to violate those. But from an investment standpoint, it would seem that at some point you might have to make those decisions with the limited dollars and expertise you have. Where can you get the most bang for the dollar? I know those are difficult decisions. But are there federal or state laws that would prohibit you from considering those factors?
Madam Chair, Senator Bryant, I am absolutely not sure. I would tell you that I have lots of things that I could tell you what I think without I would never want to tell a lawyer that. And I do know those laws fairly well, but an interesting question, which may be being litigated at this time.
Well, Sunday when we're in the hallway, I have a follow-up to it. But I'd be curious to get your read on.
I'd be glad to even see you in the hallway.
Senator Fisher?
I would like to have you counsel my colleagues and then be careful about his remarks about people 60 years of age.
They're wonderful.
A protected category.
Representative Ross, you did ask the question about the $2 million. And just to clarify, that those $2 million plus the match are then going to employ an additional 10 case managers. Is that right? Or
the actual number, I believe, is 17 positions. George actually has it quickly. 13.22 FTE. That's correct.
Okay.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, I'm going to ask Jim Ridingsword, if you would. And I'll ask Jim to introduce himself to the committee to talk about the Older Americans Act, which we will find on page 75 in your book. And Jim?
My name is Jim Ridingsword. I am the legislative chair for the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. And I'm also the Director of Senior Services for Cascades West Council of Governments, covering Lynn, Denton, and Lincoln counties. I'm actually privileged to talk to you about the Older Americans Act because it is the foundation for a lot of what Oregon has done in the last 20 years in terms of serving seniors and persons with disabilities. And also because I would
hazard to guess that if we took a survey amongst people, becoming an older Americans Act is probably a personal goal. And so it's, I'm really pleased to talk with you about that. I'm going to take and skip over much of the remarks that I've put together and just kind of limit my time in order to deal with things that you would like to deal with today. The Older Americans Act, as I said, is the foundation of much of what has happened in Oregon. Because of the Older Americans Act, there is a network of aging and disabled persons throughout the country, throughout the state, who work almost every month to deliver services to seniors and persons with disabilities. There are over 600 volunteers in Oregon who serve on local advisory councils and help local government to make decisions about services for seniors and persons with disabilities. There are today over 125,000 seniors and persons with disabilities served in Oregon through area agencies on aging and disabilities. There are over 6,000 volunteers in Oregon who daily deliver meals to shut-in seniors. As a matter of fact, the number of meals being delivered on an annual basis in Oregon today is over 3 million. The Older Americans Act is the focal point for the single access delivery system that Oregon began to develop in the late 1970s. It's a system that has become a model for the nation. And it's still important today. And I'd like to just give you two examples of why we think that it is important for the legislature to seriously consider where they are today with seniors and persons with disabilities and where you will be going in the near future. First of all, if you go back and you look at the December 1998 economic and revenue forecast, you'll find in there that there is an estimated growth in the number of persons over the age of 85 in Oregon in the next 5 years of 32%. That means that by the year 2005, we will have 15,000 more people in the state of Oregon over the age of 85. At the same time, if you do a little more research, you'll find that when people hit that threshold of 85 in our society today, 50% of them are going to need some help to get through every day. So we know that that is happening, and we know that that is a fact of life in the state of Oregon. It's what they're beginning to call in the literature a longevity boom. It's different than the baby boom. The baby boom is 30 years away. The longevity boom is here today. 15,000 more people over the age of 85 in the next 5 years.
Jim?
Yes.
Do you know what percent the state serves of senior citizens?
Through the Older Americans Act,
generally.
I would guess the last time I looked at about 10% to 15% of all seniors are served through local through the state programs. The other thing that
I'm sorry. Just to put the numbers together, so by 2005, the 15,000 additional people over 85 will be in addition to what are already here. 10% of those will be need to be served.
10% of those will probably need to be served. 50% of those will need some help every day getting through their lives, whether they pay for it themselves or whether someone else is paying for it in some other form.
And hopefully we can train our families to help do that for our parents and so forth. I know our society is sort of lax in doing that. Other societies, I think, better than we do. But
actually, Madam Chair, the latest number I saw on that when we were talking about reauthorization of the Older Americans Act a few weeks ago is that surprisingly 80% of all care given to seniors in this country is given by their families.
Encouraging.
What was that percentage?
80%.
Now, just to follow up a little bit on persons with disabilities, what happens at the local level as programs began to move to local government in the state of Oregon is that they began to be expanded and they began to serve persons with disabilities. Once again, the Old Americans Act is the foundation for us to be able to do these kinds of things. Roger talks about what they want to do for employment initiatives. Well, I've been reading for the last year, and here's what I found, and I try to bring these things down to where they make some sense to me. 73% of persons with disabilities, severe disabilities, people that have to rely on public resources for their daily living, 73% are unemployed. In a recent Gallup poll, they found that 70% of those unemployed persons with disabilities want to go to work. So this initiative that Roger is talking about is an important initiative. And it's, again, it's one of those kinds of things that Oregon has gone out and developed. So if you look at what's happening with seniors in our state and in our country, and when you consider the needs and expectations of persons with disabilities and the fact that they want to be productive members, it is the Older Americans Act and it is your local area agency on aging and disabilities that's going to put those programs in place for you and the people of Oregon. I could go into and talk about briefly some of the things that have happened to the senior and disabled services budget since 1991. But we come around and we talk with each of you individually about that. So I think I'll pass over that today. But basically say to you that the Oregon Association of Area Agencies and Disabilities have four things that they really have tried to focus on in this session. That is one, services through client employed providers. Services to persons with disabilities to help them get employed. Services to persons and seniors and persons with disabilities to give them access to transportation. And fixing the inequitable funding for the local AAAs that has occurred since the 1980s. This morning, before I came up, I just wanted to see what the Older Americans Act was and what it says. It was interesting to me. This is right out of the internet off of the Older Americans Act. This was developed 35 years ago. And what does it say that we need to think about? Adequate income and retirement. Best possible physical and mental health. Obtaining and maintaining suitable housing. A comprehensive array of community-based long-term care services, opportunities for employment, retirement in health, honor, and dignity, participation and contribution to meaningful activities, efficient government services, including access to low-cost transportation, immediate benefit from proven research and knowledge, freedom, independence, and the free exercise of individual initiative. These are the things that Congress said that we needed to do 35 years ago. And we've made progress in the last 35 years. But I think if all of us were to sit down and look over this list, we would say we need to make a lot of progress, not only for ourselves, but for our children, our grandchildren, and our great-grandchildren. And I thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you today, and I'll be happy to take any questions.
Mr. Shields?
Jim, you very subtly listed the equity issues worth on your list. I'd like you to push a little more in terms of what risks there are in the state if we don't deal with the equity issue?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, you heard my boss, Bill Wagner, speak to you last week. And we have been assessing that risk. This is the first biennium that every, quote, transfer AAA will face a shortfall in funding that they are going to have a problem with. At least two of the agencies, Clackamas County and Cascades West, without funding equity in this biennium, will need to consider their relationship that they've had for 15 years with the state. And those considerations will have to include transferring the programs back to the state by the year 2000, by probably July of 2000.
Roger, what would happen if those two actually did transfer their AAA staff back to SDSC?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, what would happen is that they would take the programs back, because under law, that's what we're obligated to do.
What would happen to the equity issue?
Well, the Madam Chair, Senator Shields, the equity issue would remain, obviously, with the other transfer AAAs. But specifically, I think what you're asking is what would be the fiscal impact. The fiscal impact is that basically we would have a hole in our budget, which we have to fill, because we would be taking those transferred employees back at state salary and state wages, state benefits.
And, Madam Chair, I'm of course making the same argument that we made at the E-Board last November, that if the AAAs were not able to continue working for 83 cents on a dollar like they do in Clackamas County, they could transfer them back. Roger would have to take them and pay them a dollar for a dollar instead of 83 cents for a dollar. I'm just trying to figure out how you avoid that.
Do you know what they're asking for? Are they asking for a dollar for a dollar?
Yeah, essentially. Oh. But they, last week when they were in here, they were saying three. What was it? What was the figure you were saying?
The we worked very hard in the last 2 years with the Department of Human Resources and Senior and Disabled Services Division to identify and assess what this problem is. And I think we're all in agreement that the funding equity that occurs, that has developed, is today $3.9 million. It will continue to grow until the problem is fixed. We believe that that is a number that we need to talk about and need to work on. We also believe that we need to take some action to fix this problem so it does not keep coming back to the legislature in the future.
If the county's employees, if the AAAs work for less of a salary, they should be able to do the job for less. Why is it then that I guess what would be our interest in not taking them back? We have to pay the state salary rate to county employees who have a different rate.
Madam Chair, I think that if you look at the salaries between state employees and county employees, you'll probably find that they're relatively equitable. Okay? What has occurred in the last 15 years is that local government has picked up the costs. The original ORS 410 anticipated that local government would enhance the programs and not pick up the cost of the transfer that occurred in the 1980s. That has not happened because, as my boss Bill Wagner says, there was a quirk that took place in the mid-1980s that needs to be addressed by the legislature or by the administration.
Representative, and maybe you could help me out with this. It's my understanding, however, that if the programs were transferred back to the state, then the state would lose the local subsidies currently operate, happening.
Madam Chair and Representative Ross, in Cascades West, for example, in assessing that, if we were to transfer back the long-term care programs, we would transfer back the Medicaid, quote, Title 19 programs. At the same time, we would still retain the Older Americans Act and the senior meals programs and protective services and all of the things that we have to do under the Older Americans Act. In our case, we would not, and I don't think any local government would, transfer local money back to the state to assist in this problem.
Okay. I think we're going to move along now, and the reason being is because we need to be finished by 2:00.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to talk briefly about adult protective services on page 73. And it just happens to be the last program area that we're going to touch on. It certainly by no means is meant to be the least important. We take this job very, very seriously by statute. Senior Disabled Services has the duty to protect the older citizen and the disabled citizen from physical and mental abuse and from fraudulent practices. By law, there are mandatory reporters, and that we need to investigate allegations of abuse against elderly individuals. Referrals for the investigations of abuse come from many sources, including family and friends, neighbors, as well as the mandatory reporters, doctors, hospitals, public officials. The types of abuse that we see, self-neglect involving clients who are no longer able to meet their own needs, neglect of care by paid and unpaid caregivers, sexual abuse, physical abuse usually associated with domestic violence, and financial abuse. Protective service workers go in and they clarify the allegations, they create an investigative game plan, they assess the capacity of the client, they conduct interviews, they gather relevant evidence, and they make a determination about whether this needs to be referred to law enforcement. They're always looking to protect the safety of the client, to make sure that no further harm is done to the client. And generally, this is a very close working relationship, not only with law enforcement, but domestic violence entities. And I think that a lot of the increase in allegations has come for the fact that we have done a lot of work letting people know about this potential abuse. We are working to try to get ahead of financial fraud in projects working with the Oregon Bankers Association to teach tellers and bank managers about how to spot financial fraud. We're also working directly with individuals and trying to get them to hang up on telemarketers and not allow themselves to be taken and their life savings to be taken away from them. So this is an area that really is, again, one which we respond very quickly to allegations, and they are some of the most complicated cases that we work with. But obviously very, very important, and a very close partnership, again, with the law enforcement entities throughout the state. And I'd be glad to take any questions, Madam Chair.
Nope.
Can I ask George Naughton to talk about the governor's recommended budget? And, George, you have a handout, which I hope everybody's found you're going to give out.
Madam Chair, as I get started, I am George Naughton with the Department of Administrative Services. Let me real briefly, give you an overview of our philosophy when we approach this budget. First, this is a very good system. Senior and Disabled Services Division under Roger has done an excellent job, and over the last couple of decades, we have built a system of long-term care that is the envy of the country, I believe. This is a very good system. When we put the budget together in the fall, we looked at this system and looked at some of our other systems through the state and decided that this was one that we could hold down a little bit to fund other areas. And roughly, we took about $25 million out of this budget and sent them to other areas, other programs within DHR, education, other areas that we thought were in more critical need. In putting those that $25 million of reductions to current service level, we tried very hard, very rigorously, to give you options that we thought were realistic. We tried to avoid taking, as you've seen in the past, 50% reductions to Oregon Project Independence or eliminating the General Assistance Program, things that you've seen in the past. I think Jim Carlson said it best yesterday that what you see here is a whole host of issues. We've taken a little bit off of a lot of different areas. Within this budget, there's only one policy package that you'll see that adds general fund. It is the employment initiative where we add $2 million. This means, as you just heard from Jim Ridingstone, that there are other issues, such as the AAA transfers, that we are forestalling off in the future. And as we have money, as we did in November of this last year, we try and add that money back into the system as we can. We simply did not have the funds to do it at this time. Let me turn real fast to my handout, and I'm going to skip most of the things on the first page and turn to the second page. I really want to make sure that you see the things that we've included in the governor's reduction. Policy package 090, which is our program reductions, the first one that you'll see lined out there is reductions in caseload projections. And really what that means in very simple terms is that we took a look at where the forecasts were based on new information, and we were able to reduce that piece of the budget by about $10 million. The second one is client-employed providers. You will see something similar, or I think you have seen something similar, with the Oregon Health Plan. We're going to look more closely at the hours we assign to client-employed provider clients and see if perhaps we can limit that down a little bit more. The savings there were about $1.4 million. Cost of living adjustments for providers, as you've seen in all the rest of the human resource programs, we limited our providers to a 2% inflationary increase per year. And as part of that, you'll see on the next one down, we eliminated nursing facility rebasing. That is, under the Boren Amendment, I think we've spoken about that before, we have eliminated that under our new options. That equated to about $3.8 million in savings. I should mention here also that in the governor's revised budget, you'll see a revenue enhancement package where we try and restore this back into the budget.
Madam Chair.
Yeah, for Senator O'Brien.
Now, the rebasing for nursing home facilities in the governor's new budget, what level is it restored to?
The percentages, right now we're at 2 and 2. The percentages can now go up to about 4.15 per year.
And in dollars?
It's about $6.7 to $7 million.
Thank you.
Providence Elder Place, this is a program.
6.7 to 7 million?
Isn't that the range?
The range is 6.3 million for adult nursing facility rebasing and just shy of 400,000 for pediatric rate rebasing.
I'm curious, is that a biannual or annual figure?
Biannual.
Biannual.
Providence Elder Place, the next one down, is the PACE program that you discussed earlier, which is a combination of acute care and long-term care up in Portland. That was a $300,000 reduction, and what we did was they have a certain capacity up there right now. We, in the governor's budget, limited them down to their current capacity. Under our new projections, that caseload is not going to rise above that, so this gets taken care of in the reshoot that you'll see later. And then the last one there is the services and supplies reduction. We have asked FDSC to come up with $1.2 million in general fund savings for themselves. Package 091 is the facility licensing fee that you've seen earlier. I think Roger has done an excellent job of describing that package and why we've come up with that, and that would be a whole of $723,000 as it stands now. The employment initiative, I think Roger's done a very good job, 13.22 positions, roughly $2.1 million general fund.
Madam Chair.
Representative Walker, a question on facility licensing fees. What does that translate into per bed?
$20.
$20 currently?
For all of them.
For all of them, okay.
There is a chart in here.
Yeah, okay.
And that's an increase in some of them. I mean, some of them now charge a dollar a day. It's adult foster homes that are charged $20 a bed.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Nursing homes,
$4.93.
Yeah. So $80.
A dollar.
Yeah.
$1. Okay. On the third page, you have already mentioned the state's administration package, which is $1.2 million in general fund savings, 5.28 FTE that are added there, the enhancement of the SSI transition team, a 6.04 FTE and a savings of about $1.8 million general fund. Then you'll see two packages here, package 310 and 320. These are the long-term care ombudsman program and the Board of Nursing program. These two programs are eligible for Medicaid funds and Older American Act funds. The money is transferred from those programs to SDSC and then spun back out with federal match and sent back to the individual program. So the amounts you see here are the policy packages included within those two budgets. The last one, package 410, is the Department of Human Resources support services, department-wide support services. That came out to be about $1.1 million, and I believe that you will address that budget later this week. The final issue I'd like to bring up is the governor's revised budget. We will have a rebalance and reshoot coming up very quickly. As part of that revision, we are going to have, as I mentioned, $50 million revenue enhancement package that we're going to receive approval now for from the Healthcare Financing Administration, and we will go into more details of that later. If there are any questions, Madam Chair,
are there questions? And so you're going to come out with a $50 million revenue enhancement package later, and this will impact some of these policy packages that are in front of us?
Madam Chair, the package will generate about $75 million in additional money that you can use for 99-2001.
Okay. And, okay, so this is the maximum Medicaid match for the nursing home. Okay.
Yeah.
So we don't need to look. We'll not talk about that today.
Right.
Right.
But
and we are going to have the rebalance next week.
Okay, and the rebalance is next week. Okay, one thing I did want to ask was the OPI, is that in the reduced caseload projections? Is that where that shows up?
Madam Chair, Representative Ross, that is exactly where it shows up.
Okay, and that total is $10 million reduction. And what are the other components to, you say, the further declines in nursing home case reduction, impairment rate provide to community-based care providers? What are the other pieces of that? I understand that about $3 million of it is OPI. What's the other piece of the rest of it?
Madam Chair and Representative Ross, I think it would be best for me to give you a handout of that instead of walking through every individual item.
Thank you.
Under policy packages 090, it says the net impact of these changes is a reduction of 24.1 million general funds and 45 million total funds, an increase of 10 positions. Now, how can we have reduction of funds and an increase of positions?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, that's a very good question. And the reason here is that it's a caseload mix issue. Our nursing facilities are dropping very rapidly. And the issue is that it does not take very many staff to manage folks that are in nursing facilities because they are a pretty dense population group. When we go over to the long-term care, the substitute home side, your assisted living facilities, your residential care facilities, your staffing ratio rises much more quickly because your folks are spread out over a larger area. That substitute home part of the budget is increasing very rapidly. And so even though we have a net reduction in dollars, it takes more staff because of where the clients are choosing to live.
Well, and some have larger or more staff ratio.
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, that is correct.
Okay, if that completes the questions, we will close our public hearing on 5029. Thank you very much.
Here.
And we'll be seeing you maybe, or at least we'll be seeing Gert Eaton and
we'll
George. we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5501, the Commission for the Blind. I want to tell the committee my intention, by the end of this day, I have to open a work session on this, or we will have to schedule this, and I would prefer that actually, if we can do the work session, great. But I need to maintain a quorum.
We're not
going to
finish
the
work session today.
Do mind? But I do need to open it. And we need a quorum for that. That is my point in telling you that.
Like the record to note that Senator Shields isn't here.
Right. Okay.
Madam Chair, I will be here about 10:00.
Great, thank you. Okay, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. I'm Chuck Young, the Administrator of the Commission for the Blind. I would like, if I could, to give you an overview of the budget and then perhaps have Mrs. Mock, the Director of our Rehabilitation Program, walk you through that program. I would like to start. I think you have a handout up there that has just the cover sheet that mentions the Commission for the Blind and who the commissioners are. This is the sheet from which this 19-page handout is what I'll be working from. It starts out on the second page with the mission of the Commission for the Blind is to assist blind Oregonians in making informed choices and decisions to achieve full inclusion, and I can't stress anymore, the integration in society through employment, independent living, and social self-sufficiency. And I'd like to elaborate, if I could, by saying that our philosophy behind our services of the Commission for the Blind is that we do not provide housing to blind people, but rather we teach them how to live in the community in the same housing that the larger community lives. We do not provide recreational opportunities for blind people, but rather we hopefully give them the skills so they can participate in the recreation as other people in the larger community. And with one or two very small exceptions, we do not provide employment for blind people, but rather we give them the skills to function and compete in employment with the larger society. The next thing I would like to bring your attention to, the agency has two major objectives for our services with two distinctly different funding streams, and this can get rather confusing because you cannot move the funding stream from one to the other or the eligibility requirement from one program to the other. The first is the Vocational Rehabilitation Services Program, and that's for people who intend to work as the outcome of their services, and that's a very, very large part of our total agency and our total budget. And then we have a very much smaller in financial resources program for older blind people and independent living services. And this program actually serves more people in total numbers, but has a very small in proportion funding stream. We serve legally blind Oregonians, and that is defined by people whose best vision in their best eye after all attempts at correction are made cannot be greater than 2200 degrees, and that simply means if I can recognize one of you with corrected vision from 200 feet, somebody who barely meets the legal definition of blindness would have to get 20 feet away before they could recognize you. That's in their best eye after every form of correction has been made. Mm-hmm. The other definition of legal blindness is your peripheral vision has to be reduced down to 20 degrees or less. And that is equivalent to looking at the world through, if you went to McDonald's, you got two soda straws, and you look through, you just see two dots straight ahead. Those are the two descriptors of what constitutes legal blindness. We also work with businesses in Oregon who intend to work with visually impaired or blind employees, either to hire them or if they have a person who becomes visually impaired or blind on the job, if you will. We provide a continuum of services from youth transition from school all the way up to the older blind population. And I have in the margins there the Oregon Revised Statutes, which gives us either the authority to provide these programs or requires us or mandates us to provide them. We also provide employment counseling and training and job placement services. And again, it gives you the statutory authority for that. We also provide resources to employers to help them employ visually impaired and blind individuals. We provide training and enable people to remain in their homes and their communities. We provide supported employment to a very small population of severely multiply handicapped people who cannot be employed
without significant support or assistance from other people. We have or provide a public education program to educate the public about the capabilities of blind people, hopefully so that we can more easily integrate blind people into the larger society. And finally, we are required to maintain a registry of all known blind Oregonians who are legally blind in this state.
Okay. How is that? How many people do we have there?
The registry is somewhat over 7,000 people at the present time, and it's derived from all that we go to cooperative agreement from just about every optometrist and ophthalmologist and school district.
You think that's
state.
Fairly accurate?
I think it's as accurate as any register. Yes, I think
fine.
So.
Go ahead.
I'll give you a little background. As recently as 50 years ago, blind Oregonians lived in institutions, and in Oregon, it was the Oregon Blind Trade School. If you've ever visited the Multnomah School for the Bible, that college campus in Portland, Oregon, used to be the Oregon Blind Trade School. And if you were blind, you were sent there and you stayed there for the rest of your life. And they had a men's dormitory and a women's dormitory. And they had a workshop or facility called the Oregon Industries for the Blind. And when they broke up that facility in 1937, we inherited the Oregon Industries for the Blind. And that's partly how we got the present-day Oregon Industries for the Blind. At that time, as recently as 20 years ago, most jobs for blind people were either in workshops or they were involved in manufacturing brooms and mops or tuning pianos. Today, through changes in attitudes and technology, we're able to extend a much more creative opportunities to blind people, hopefully that they can be involved in just about any job that sighted non-handicapped people can be involved with the exception of things like taxi driver and pilot and things that definitely require a vision. This has radically changed in the last 10 years due to technology, and anything that can be put on a computer can now be made accessible to a blind person. At the same time, the older blind population has grown at an astonishing rate. Most causes of blindness are age-related. The three most common causes of macular degeneration, cataracts, and glaucoma are all age-related causes of blindness. So we have a rapidly growing population in this area. I will mention also that the Commission for the Blind is a consumer-controlled agency by statute, and the governor appoints and the Senate confirms at least four members who must be people who are blind themselves, and the remaining members are chosen from the area of employers, labor, ophthalmology, and optometry, and also education of the blind is given preference to the board. The first program, again, we have two highly visible objectives with different funding streams. The first one I'll mention is the Vocational Rehabilitation Program. And here we serve eligible clients who want to go to work. This is a state and federal partnership with the United States Department of Education Rehabilitation Services Administration. We receive an allotment of money from them. We receive 12.5% of it for services for the Commission for the Blind, and the remaining 87% of the federal money is split with the Vocational Rehabilitation Division. Both us and the Vocational Rehabilitation Division are required to provide a 21.3% match of either general funds or other funds. The Rehabilitation Act, which funds this program, describes who is eligible and what services may be provided, and the Federal Rehabilitation Services Administration monitors both us and the Vocational Rehabilitation Agency for compliance. We provide core vocational rehabilitation programs in this area, and this is under an individualized plan to achieve employment for each person. We also operate an orientation and career and technology center, which is a residential center in Portland. It's an intensive training program. This program is the one program within the vocational rehabilitation program that has a wait list. It has a 6-month wait list. This one program within VocRehab. Unlike the older blind program, which we'll get to later, which has its own wait list and its own eligibility requirements. We also operate a business enterprise program that's defined in statutes what that comprises, but basically here we have preference of provide food service vending on state, county, and municipal properties. So we have snack bars, cafeterias, dry stands, and some vending on the interstate highways, wherein we train blind people to manage these business opportunities.
Before you turn, I wanted to ask about the Orientation Career and Technology Center. Do you make use of the blind school during the summer for various training opportunities and that kind of thing?
Very extensively, yes, Chairman, we do.
Thank you.
We have several cooperative projects with them throughout the year and all summer long, particularly spring break and stuff like that, where we work cooperatively. And our Salem offices are located on the campus of the School for the Blind. We work very closely with them.
So, essentially, all summer long, the facility is in use, or you sporadically use the facility?
My understanding is in use all summer long.
Okay. And what kinds of things do they do again?
We have a transition from school to work program where we help any blind youth between 15 and 21 years of age get a summer job. And we house the students, for the most part, at Reed College in Portland. But for those kids who are too severely disabled to live in a college dormitory and cook their own meals, we have another project in cooperation with School for the Blind where they live at the campus through the summer at the School for the Blind, and the School for the Blind staff, you know, cafeteria and what have you, their dormitory staff assist with this project. And these youth work on supported jobs here in the Salem community, and they oversee that project in cooperation with us.
So they're still kids.
They're youth between 15 and 21 years of age.
Do you ever use the blind school for like a college dorms do during the summer, like for elder hostels, and have the elderly come and participate in classes? In this case, use that facility for some of these elder blind, these people who have gone blind in later years, and help them with their, maybe not for career, but actually for their life still?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do that a lot with local community centers. For instance, senior service centers in each of the communities, we offer classes in these in cooperation with their staff. We don't use the School for the Blind much for that. We try to use the services where adults would normally receive the services in the community. Again, we're trying, our philosophy is always trying to get our population integrated into the larger community, not offer separate, distinct, segregated services. So we try to work with all the senior centers, the nursing homes, sometimes we use the facilities, the community college. We try to go to where adults normally would go who weren't blind and use those facilities. And most of the senior centers are very cooperative in working with our staff to use their facilities for cooking. I know I was involved in one in Coos Bay here a couple months ago that they had cooking classes and went for everybody in the community. But that was normally done in an adult facility, not the School for the Blind.
Well, the reason I ask that question is not that I want to segregate these people from their community, but it seems to me that it would be an opportunity where they could stay there, learn some skills, then go to the community and participate in a whole lot of different things in senior centers. But it seems to me that some of these people, and you heard some of the testimony that was here the other day, are fairly devastated by the fact that they are blind later in life, and they feel very helpless. And I just think that there could be a very effective program if they were given intensive training, even if it was away, because there are dorms there. There are places to live there. And, I could even envision that their spouses or maybe some other family member would be amenable to using that facility, putting really good use to that facility in that way. And I would encourage you to look at a program like that.
Here, if I might, I couldn't agree with you more. The problem is not the facilities. The problem is the staff to run those programs. We do not have enough staff to run those programs. That is the nub of the problem. The Oregon Industry for the Blind is another program that we are mandated to offer in Portland. And this is a cooperative project in conjunction with the Multnomah County Mental Health Division. And it's a work activity center for the most severely disabled individuals who are also visually impaired or blind. And I cannot stress when I say most of these people have IQ levels that are so small that they cannot be measured. Most of these people do not have communication skills, cannot be toileted individually, and I could go on with that if you want. But if you can envision, that's for a very small population of the most severely disabled individuals that we serve within the agency. And that, again, that was a program that transitioned over from the old Oregon Blind Trade School and the state management institution for blind individuals.
And do you know how many people it serves and what it costs?
It serves 51 consumers, and it has 21 staff, and it costs the county, Multnomah County, do we have that figure? So that's
I need to look that up. It has a total budget and expenditure limitation of $1,331,000 per biennium of other funds.
And these other funds are from?
These are funds that are the mental health division that is responsible for development of disabled people provides slots in the community for people to work with people who are MRDD. Those slots are assigned each individual. They require a staffing ratio of, I believe it's at least 3-1, staff, 1-7 for every 3 individuals. That money is the money that's paid to us by the Multnomah County Mental Health Division and to serve 51 people for a biennium.
This is from Multnomah County, you're saying?
Yes.
Okay.
Each one of these persons comes with a certain dollar amount that they'll pay for the services, and we agree to provide the services for that fee.
One staff per 3 clients?
One staff per 3 that is recommended.
Okay.
In fact, I think it's required. I think it's required because of the need. These people have to be helped in and out of the building.
Like about done that.
Yeah, okay. I don't want to. Then I would like to mention the other program that we offer that has a totally different funding source is the independent living services for eligible individuals who do not have an employment goal. These are older blind people over the age of 55, and we provide services for them to remain in their homes in their communities. And I think we have, is it 5 teachers? Half-time or full-time? Okay. Yeah. We have 5 half-time teachers in the state of Oregon that provide services for this population. And this is provided at a very low 10% federal match, but we maximize all of Oregon's share of this program.
And how many are served in this program?
I believe it's close to 900 a year. I think it's dropped down in recent years to a couple pages back. I will be getting that, but it's like 750 individuals a year.
Thank you.
On page 11, 962 people a year. With that overview, there's also a flow chart on the next page that shows sort of the separation of the programs. I don't know that we need to spend much time on that, but I'll walk you through it. With that, we can get into detail, if you like, on the vocational rehabilitation program. And Mrs. Mock is the director of that program. I would turn to her to present the vocational program, if that would be of your pleasure.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Linda Mock, and I'm director of rehabilitation services at the Commission for the Blind. And that principally involves the vocational rehabilitation program, which, as Mr. Yang has described to you, is a program with the goal of employment for individuals who have lost their vision. We focus on helping them secure and or maintain their employment. Clients come to us and we help evaluate their skills, plan a vocational goal with them with the professional guidance of a vocational rehabilitation counselor. They then may have training, including training within our agency or other training outside, which will help them achieve their goal. We work as a team with the clients as well as the businesses to help people obtain successful employment. Our goal is to give clients the confidence and skills that are necessary for successful employment so that they can maintain their independence while continuing to contribute to society. Our eligibility criteria is very similar to what you heard for the Vocational Rehabilitation Division, with the exception that the physical disability that our clients possess is legal blindness. And this legal blindness must be an impediment to the individual in terms of their employment, and they must require our services in order to either maintain or obtain their employment. We currently do not have a waiting list for this program to enter the program. If you look on page 6, we've created a flow chart for you, which will describe the process that an individual goes through when they come to the vocational rehabilitation program. Initially, we do an eligibility determination. If it's found that they're eligible under the criteria I just described, They then work with their counselor to develop what we call an individualized plan for employment. Within that plan, we have two major tracks we've described for you here. One would be for someone who has what we're calling the blindness skills, the basic ability to travel, communicate, access print. If they do not have those, we'll go through that first because it's a longer, more expensive training program, and actually that is the majority of the people because 75% of the people that we serve in this program have previously been sighted and have lost their vision as adults. So most of them do need the skills related to blindness. So they would then, and they do have choice on whether they would be referred to our orientation center in Portland where we have in-depth training for them, or they may be referred to rehabilitation teachers for training in their home community. We do have some teachers around the state who can provide training in the community. It is less intensive and will take them a longer period of time, but for some people, they're not able to leave their home or don't wish to, so they don't come to the training center in Portland. While they're in the training, they will learn skills such as cooking, personal management, reading with magnifiers, Braille, if they have the need for Braille reading. They'll learn how to pay bills, do daily tasks like how to coordinate their cooking, how to dress, things that are everyday tasks that they previously were able to do with vision and now don't have adequate vision to. And one of the most significant areas is teaching them how to travel with a cane so that they can once again move around independently because obviously none of our clients are able to drive any longer. Once they've obtained their basic skills, so now that they are again able to do normal daily living tasks, they continue with their individualized plan to become job ready. Now, some people may be going and using transferable skills that they had previously prior to their vision loss. Others may need to or may choose to look at new areas depending on what their past skills were. So we have a career exploration program, which is a program designed for people who don't know what their goal is to help them choose a vocational goal that's appropriate to their interests and capabilities. We also can help them with academic training. Some of our clients do go onto university training and various kinds of specific skills training. We also train them on how to actually do a job search, how to interview, and can assist with on-the-job training. Once they've completed that type of training, then the counselor and they work together to secure employment. Once we have placed them in employment, many times we do assist with job restructuring and consultation and technical assistance for technology on the job. So they may have learned how to use, for example, speech or enlargement on a computer while they were in training, but now they're on a job and they're going to have a specific software that will interface with their employers. Network system, that sort of thing. So we have consultants who would go out with the employers to recommend a system, and then sometimes the employer is able to purchase that. Sometimes we assist in the actual purchase of the adaptive equipment. We follow them for at least 90 days once they've been successfully placed. That is a requirement within the Rehab Act. In reality, many times we follow a little bit longer than that to make sure that the situation is stable. At that point, the case is closed. We are a time-limited type of service. If in the future the individual has needs related to that employment, either their disability changes or aspects of the work change, we see this a lot with computerization, with systems change, and they may need to come back to us for some minor assistance to keep them on the job. We are able to do that in what we call post-employment services.
Is there an age limitation?
No, there is not. As long as they're interested in employment and that's their goal, we don't have any age requirements.
Okay. But they have to be interested in employment. It can't be something that, how about being self-employed?
Self-employed is acceptable. We consider that an employment outcome. And in fact, within the recent reauthorization of the Rehab Act, there was a lot of emphasis on self-employment, encouraging our agencies to assist with that. And we do see a number of individuals. And in fact, I think with the aging population, we're seeing a number of people who are retirement age wanting to have some form of self-employment on the side to assist them with supplemental income. And so we do assist individuals.
And the reason I ask this, again, is because of Mr. Weddington, who came and testified, mm-hmm. a former surgeon, an educated man, very well-spoken, probably could write and speak and do a lot of things motivationally for people.
if he would have some help to move from where he was to a new place.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of that would happen through support of, you know, other folks around him, encouraging him and telling him that his wife is still useful.
Mm-hmm.
But I was just so struck by his testimony and so bothered that he hadn't gotten help, didn't even know there was any services, nor did his son. And we've talked about that later. Some of us have talked about why that might have happened. He's got so much to give.
Madam Chair, I think that is the dilemma of not having adequate services for the older blind. And we see those kinds of situations a lot where there's a lot of potential with individuals and, we don't have, principally the funding that we get for the older blind program does go into staffing to work with people, but it's very minimal and it does create that issue where we have inadequate services around the state.
But he couldn't fit into this.
If he had some kind of an appointment goal,
thinking,
yeah.
Why, I mean, that would be.
He could if you had that as a goal.
Well, that would have to be his stated goal.
Yeah, and actually, I mean, we did actually provide some services to that gentleman. I think he doesn't recall it, but we did have a teacher go and meet with him from the older blind program a few years ago, and at that point he wasn't interested. In seeking any kind of employment area. Yeah. If you turn to the next page, it lists out the core services that we have. We have career assessment, evaluation of needs, career training, technology assessment, equipment acquisition, job placement, and continuing consultation. And this is really offering classes on adjustment to blindness. And helping people realize what the possibilities are once they've lost their vision, because we realize that is an important factor. Another major...
Just to follow up on that and the chair's comments, these classes to adjust to blindness, just from the outside it would seem that many blind people would be extremely depressed and lacking in motivation because of their depression that would block action. Do you seek either individual counseling or medication or assistance in adjusting to that blindness other than this in a class setting?
Yeah, under the vocational rehabilitation program, we have the ability to provide a wide range of services. And you're right, there are many times for someone who's newly blind, depression is certainly something that can accompany it. And so we can provide peer support and counseling within our agency, but we can also purchase outside counseling for individuals if we feel that it's to a clinical level where they need that type of counseling. We have also worked closely with a group called Vision Northwest, which is a peer support group around the state, which has been very beneficial in helping people with realizing what the possibilities are by seeing other blind people functioning and being able to talk about those issues, because many times people feel like they're the only individual that has ever experienced this problem, and they really do find some comfort in having other people they can talk with. So we do a lot of that kind of thing. We do what we call living with blindness seminars, which we take individuals off for a weekend to deal specifically with adjustment, and we can also do those. We do ones we call couple seminars where a person can bring their spouse with them to deal with issues within the family. We've also done various forms of them with specialty groups like diabetics. We did one with older people. We've done them with lots of interest groups to try to help them realize what their potential is and also, the depressing issues that some of them are.
And just to follow up with that, but it sounds like most of those more intensive, proactive responses to depression are in connection with the vocational rehabilitation program rather than being in response to the older, newly blind.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, that is true.
Madam Chairman, I would comment that this is such a pervasive problem that many individuals upon being diagnosed as legally blind never hear the doctor say that, refuse to hear the doctor say that, and will often go with 3 or 4 years before they will be willing to work with us, because to work with us is an admission that you are legally blind and that you're going to be legally blind, and that can't be reversed. And that is so difficult for so many people that many people will refuse our services. And when they finally do come to where they're willing to work with us, then they often tell, my doctor never told me I was blind. And we go back to the doctor and say, why didn't you tell? I don't even ask the doctors anymore, because the doctors say, I told them 3 times. and they do not want to become blind, and they're afraid if they become blind, they're going to be victimized by society. They try to hide it, try to deny it. So it makes it very difficult sometimes for us to get people on board. There are also consumer organizations of blind people that we highly recommend to the people to associate, and many of these individuals will not associate with those groups because they don't want to be visually impaired or blind.
Thank you.
And now we'll switch to the other end of the continuum for a moment, to our youth transition program. We do have a very strong transition program within the agency because we realize the need for students to have summer work experiences similar to those that most of us had and most sighted students have. Well, about 25 years ago, we actually started having the summer work experience programs, and we have done them in strong cooperation with the regional programs and the School for the Blind. They help provide funding for them through cooperative agreements. We have two locations where we offer these programs. We offer, the main one is in Portland. We use the campus of Reed College. Students who are in that program live in a dormitory together. They prepare meals together. They use public transportation, take TriMet to and from their job, and work in community jobs. And we use some JTPA funding as well to help fund that program. We also have a program in Salem, what we were talking about a little bit earlier, at the School for the Blind. This is for students who need the supportive employment model. In other words, they have to have a job coach to help them on the job. They're not able to travel independently, so they have assisted transportation to and from their job. And I might mention also that there are a number of other programs that go on at the School for the Blind during the summer where they have students come in from around the state for lots of different levels of training. And they are for younger students, so the school is actually a pretty busy place in the summer. We also have, as a part of that program, a college preparation class for students who are interested in going on to college. We do that in conjunction with Western Oregon State University. Students go and live at the university for a couple of weeks. They take classes to experience that. They eat dorm food. They also learn how to take notes, how to order books, how to work with the bookstore, how to work with disability students, offices, and that kind of thing. So that has been a very successful program to help students when they do graduate and go on to college to be successful and have the skills that they need. We try to do that between their sophomore and junior year, so if we find some areas where they need some remedial work, such as note-taking or that sort of thing, that they can work on that in their final year of school with the regional program. Our Orientation and Career Center is the main training program that we have in the Portland area. It does receive its referral from our counselors, and as I said, a large portion of our clients who become blind have this happen while they're adult, they need to get what we call adaptive skills. So they come to Portland, they stay in apartments while they develop these very specialized skills, such as adaptive computer technology and learning to travel with a cane. Clients at the center attend classes 6 hours a day, 5 days a week, until they reach their goals. The average time that they are there is from 3 to 6 months. They leave their families and they and their communities to live in our apartments. And this commitment makes it possible for them to return to work as quickly as possible. And they move forward on their vocation plans very quickly. If they do their training in their community, it will take longer.
How many people does this serve?
You know, I don't have a number. We do have that on the larger budget, and I don't have it off. I could get back. I just don't recall it off the top of my head. We also have a business enterprise program, which is for people who have a specific vocational goal to be a small business owner. And these are small businesses that are maintained mostly in public buildings operated by qualified blind individuals. This program includes the initial evaluation and training of the operators, in-service training for current operators, management support, and negotiations related to establishing new businesses. And we have a relatively small portion of our clients who go into that program. And I think Mr. Young has already probably described adequately for you the industry program for the blind. It is solely supported by county and production contracts. It is a sheltered workshop for multiply disabled individuals. And these workers do require constant support in order to be able to continue to do their work tasks, and they are paid on a piece rate, and some of them actually are even in an activity program because they aren't able to work. If you go to page 10, you'll see the leading causes of blindness in the vocationally aged group, we chose the cutoff age of about 65, because that is the age we're over that we don't find very many people. We do find some, but not a lot, who are interested in employment. And the leading causes are optic nerve atrophy, diabetic retinopathy, retinitis pigmentosa, and macular degeneration is fourth, with only 7%, which when you get to older blind, you'll see that it really shoots up. The other category is so large because it really covers a big variety of conditions that have less than 5% of incidence. There's many, many causes of blindness. It includes traumatic brain injury, just a wide range. And rather than list out ones that were really small incidence, we grouped those together. If we look at our rate of growth over the last few bienniums since 1992, we have seen a 36% growth rate in our VR program. And the main factor that we feel is driving the cost of this program is the significant cost of technology. About one-third of our case costs are related to technology. And as the workplace has become more and more computerized, additional technology has been required for blind individuals to be employed. Although this technology can be expensive, it does make many jobs accessible that previously couldn't be performed at all by someone who is blind. And the frequency with which we see this technology being needed is definitely a cost-driving factor.
Madam Chair, if you'd like to answer this question. The orientation program contains 10.5 full-time equivalent positions. The number of clients served has grown in the past 5 fiscal years from 608 in fiscal year 1993 to 856 in fiscal year 1995. So last year we reported to the Fed was 856 clients in that program with 10 staff. All of our budget figures are from our federal reports, and when we finalize our federal reports, and that's usually a year or two behind where we're at.
Okay.
No, I'd say 85 and 95. If I said
95.
95.
Thank you.
Do you have any questions about the vocational rehabilitation program at this point?
Any questions? Yeah.
Madam Chair, if I could continue on page 11, the Independent Living and the Older Blind Services Program. These are the services provided by 5 qualified rehabilitation teachers who are devoted half-time to serving older blind people around the state. We feel that with instruction and practice, most older blind people can learn to do everyday tasks in new ways and therefore minimize their dependence on family and friends and maximize their ability to remain in their homes and in the communities. According to the AARP, American Association of Retired Persons, only 5% of the elderly in general live in institutions, in contrast to 30% of the elderly who are also blind are living in institutions. And then we have found that an investment of about $450 in staff time and equipment, like magnifiers, these older blind people can, avoid much more costly supported care. And you're going to find out later that contrasts nationally with everybody else is reporting $600 a person, so we're way under what the national average is. There is a wait list for this program, unlike the vocational rehabilitation program we discussed earlier. We currently know of 55 persons waiting on a list in the Salem area, and we are aware of 36 people waiting on a list in the Portland area, and other areas of the state report smaller wait lists. I might mention, though, that when we do not have the staff to provide the services, such as in Salem, then the referrals dry up because people assume we have not had a teacher in Salem for some time now. Has it been 1 year? Almost a year since we've had. And the Salem office serves also Central Oregon. Each of the staff serve a 7 or 8 county area. So when you don't have a teacher in one area, you're missing 7 or 8 counties.
You just haven't been able to fill that position?
No, what happened was, and it comes up later on, we wrote some grants. And so at one time we had a 3-year large federal grant to enhance the number of older blind people served well beyond our federal grant. And so we had staff much more, and we had several more staff. We had 2 more teachers in this program funded with grant money. And we used Social Security reimbursement money when that grant ran out. It had a 3-year life on it. And once that ran out, we used Social Security money and all the other carryover money we could. So we were able to keep that
teacher position in Salem for about 5 years. When we finally had to bite the bullet and lay somebody off, we laid off people according to who had the least seniority so that we wouldn't get bumping all over the state and all that would entail. Salem person happened to be the last hired teacher, so that was the first to be laid off. And the other one was just attrition. We had a vacant position, so it was important. Excuse me, the other person laid off was important.
How long is the wait list? How long would you have to wait in Salem to get services now? Forever.
So we can get a teacher that comes down from Portland and covers that, and that's a long.
What is that? How long is that? How long is the wait in Portland?
Essentially, we're not serving this part.
So how long is the wait in Portland?
We have 36 people on the list in Portland, 55 that we know of in Salem.
I said, I'm sorry, I didn't make my question clear. How long would a person in Portland have to wait to get served?
About 2 months. 2 to 3 months, I'm told.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Again, we list all the types of services, personal management, live independent, orientation, mobility, written communication skills, activities of daily living such as meal preparation, shopping, clothes, use of functional vision, how to maximize their use of their remaining vision that they have, and we provide counseling, often cooperation with community centers. Net. On page 13, you have a graph of ages of blind Oregonians known to the Commission's line from our register, and as you can see, 63% of these individuals are over 63 of the known percent of the known blind people in the state of Oregon are over 65 years of age, while only 37% of the known blind people in the state are under that age. And then in the next graph, you see a picture of the leading causes of blindness or age-related and macular degeneration. By far, the heavyweight champion of causes of blindness in this state or any state for that matter. And then you get an explanation about how we had a unique grant for 3 years, factors that drive the cost, which caused a problem with not having a teacher anymore in the Salem area and laying off one in Portland. And then we talk about that we've applied for every possible grant you can imagine to try to remedy this situation. We recently got a $24,000 grant to serve people on the South Coast. Cost savings, some of the things in Eastern Oregon, population scale. So we have a 3 to 4 hour classes, as I think the chair talked about, are taught in various communities, and they meet every 2 to 3 weeks when the teacher can travel out into that community to put on the classes, and we try to bring the local people to that. Another teacher has a 1 day living with low vision seminar, and she offers this to three different populations, the older people themselves, the healthcare professionals from that community, and the family members to try to elicit as much support as we can from other individuals. We closed 2 small offices because the teachers going out and working in the community, it didn't seem wise to spend the money for an office. Just let them put an answering machine and a computer in their house and then go right from their home to work because they're out visiting with clients in the community. There's no need to stop by an office, in our opinion, is one of the cost savings. Per unit cost compared with other programs, we are spending $450 per client in Oregon, and this is compared to the other states' reports spending $600. This is from the federal reports that we have to turn in each year. We also have some rates of growth comparisons. The governor's projections of the number of Oregonians aged 55 and older is projected to reach 1 million people by the year 2001. And the Veterans Administration estimates that 7% of this group will have severe visual impairments. And so if you use these estimates, you come up that by the year 2001, we should anticipate 70,000 Oregonians eligible for our older blind program. Currently, we're able to serve somewhat under 1,000 per year. Referral sources for our program, most of these referral sources are either self-referred or more often we have agreements with just about every eye doctor in every school district in the state to notify if they know of any visually impaired or blind person so they can reach out to them. We partner very well with eye care professionals, and we have both the optometrist and the ophthalmologist represented on our commission board. We work very closely with the regional special ed programs and have many cooperative agreements with them.
We work very closely with the School for the Blind. Projects with Industry is a very unique private industry project, and we work with private industry. The Job Training and Partnership Act provides funding for our youth transition kids for their summer jobs. We work with Independent Living Center and all the local government. And Oregon is unique in that it is the home of Vision Northwest, and it's an organization started in the private sector, a peer support for newly visually impaired and blind people. And it started in Oregon and has spread into southern Washington. And they have some 250 groups around the state of visually impaired individuals to give peer support. And we work very close with that group. One of the people that testified the other day was the Salem president of the Salem chapter leader of the peer support group. So, again, we're fortunate because I've never seen these peer support groups anywhere else outside of the Northwest. Youth transition programs, again, we cooperate with the regional programs, School for Blind, Department of Education, School District, JEFTA to fund the jobs. The IM Care International Machinist Union is a very unique partnership that we have. The International Machinist Union has a grant program to provide job placement services and job training, and they partner with us, and they have 2.5 staff located in our office, which they pay for and help people get jobs. Again, we work with Employment Service, the one-stop centers. We work with the Southern Oregon Goodwill to provide technology services to blind people. We granted them equipment so they can teach some people. Under community visibility, our office.
Yes. I'm going to pause for a moment. We are going to open the work session on Senate Bill 5501, which is the Commission for the Blind. And we're probably going to go ahead and close the work session. Or do we need to
leave it? I think we need to leave it open.
Okay, we'll leave it open until we adjourn. So go ahead and start
some more. Is staff going to give us some material today so that we will have a background for?
I can give you the material today or tomorrow, whatever your pleasure is.
Well, it's really helpful if we're going to decide on something to know, at least in general outline, what's going to happen.
Fine. Thank you. So while he's passing that out, Mr. Young, you can go ahead and continue with your
community. I just mentioned we have offices in Portland, Salem, Eugene, Medford, Bend, and Coos Bay. We are in the phone books of all the major municipalities, both in the white pages and the blue pages. We have a toll-free 800 number. We have a website. We hold community meetings around the state. We have open houses to try to reach out to our customers. We publish a resource guide on tips to function with a visual impairment, and those resource guides have received great favor by the optometrists and ophthalmologists and are available in every doctor's office in the state. I would say we make mailings out to doctors or reach out to them to find our customers. We require each of our field offices to have a diversity plan to reach out to the minority groups within their community. Our program evaluation efforts and federal reports, we're reviewed constantly by the our federal partners. We do case reviews where we have a computer pick a random sample of cases to review. We have the staff review those to see how we can better serve individuals. We do customer satisfaction service every year, not only in-house, but we also use outside contractors to provide the service. We hold public hearings. Commission meetings are open public meetings, and they're at least every 2 months in locations throughout the state. I would say we receive 10 positive letters for every complaint letter that's forwarded to the agency from the governor's office or the legislature. Thing I'm extremely proud of, the State Management Association of Managers within State Government began in the early 90s presenting awards to state agencies for outstanding services. We were presented the best agency in the use of resources, and this award I was most proud of because it says that we did a better job of partnering with other people within state government and other agencies in the public sector, and we were, the first recipient of that award. We also received the Best Agency for Customer Service Award and the Best Agency to Work For Awards in the early years. We no longer apply for those awards because we think that we've demonstrated the
the cases when we're very appreciative. Agency results, the average hourly wage of our consumers upon closure is $10.17 an hour when they go to work. That's the starting wage. An independent survey found that 93% of our clients were still working 2 years after we closed their case. 87% of the clients receiving service were successfully employed. 89% of the clients said that the quality of service they received the commission was either excellent or good. 93% of our consumers said that they were satisfied with the services they received. All of our clients are informed their rights, appeal rights to appeal if they don't feel they're satisfactorily served, and there's an independent ombudsman service provided. And we last had a request for a hearing regarding our services in 1992, and I think the history of the agencies, we've only had three or four contested cases in the 20-some years I've been associated with it, which is probably the lowest in the nation. We ranked seventh in the last federal report nationwide in the number of employment outcomes. We also ranked seventh in the nation in the ratio of employment closures to expenditures. And we expect that this next year we will be much higher than seventh because we had a banner year. We had the best year ever in placement in the history of the agency last year. And those reports haven't been submitted yet. Continuous efforts to improve the agency. We were very involved in streamlining procedures, everything from services to streamlining the purchase procedures. Recently, the rehabilitation services effort was nationwide was awarded the Hammer Award by Vice President Gore for our efforts in streamlining government, and Oregon took a lead in preparing the Aspen document, which was infamous for state VR agencies to streamline. We are also having much success with a new concept of having rehabilitation teams and peer facilitators with our clients. And we are having clients who traditionally are having difficulty in achieving employment. We've asked them to form a team of, or a board of directors, if they would, of their family, friends, and loved ones, and people who they think care the most about them. And then we work with that team with the objective, the purpose of the services to get an employment outcome. And the team members all each take a piece of the action to ensure that, you know, Mary or John gets a job. And these, you know, some members on the team will help with the transportation. Some members volunteer to help with the housing situation, but we're experimenting with that concept and having some pretty good luck. Focused on employment, we authored several nationally publicized papers on employment outcomes and success for people with disabilities, and we've developed three videotapes that are being featured nationally. Rehab assistants, we recently converted all of our clerical and secretary positions to rehab assistants so we could have more direct service people, so that the what used to be clerical staff now provide client services. We've computerized our caseload, and we are year two compliant, we hope, when we get this latest program finally tested. We have the highest percentage of employees with disabilities of any state agency, and we work very diligently on our diversity plan. We have an extremely low turnover within our staff. We have our new agency has no budget-related legislation. The governor has recommended, and I don't know if you want me to get into this, but the governor's representative is here, and that would be part of her report.
What we'll do is have Lisa present tomorrow, first thing, and then John will present the LFO recommendations. And so, Mr. Young, the question that I have for you, and that I'm kind of left with, that maybe I could allow you just a few minutes tomorrow, and I just maybe need to understand it better, but there seems to be, from the testimony that we had from the commission earlier on, we had individuals coming forward and saying how the Blind Commission had helped them with technology, with transportation, it just seemed like there was a lot of things that the Blind Commission did, which has to cost money. On the other side, I see a tremendous number of people on waiting lists, a half-time teacher that can't be filled. I do not understand all of this about how there can be such a disparity from people saying that I got a computer and I got this and that. And that, I mean, it just seemed to me like these people were getting a lot of stuff, and that costs money.
and we don't have time, we don't have a half-time teacher in Salem. So I would like help understanding why it is that these funds seem to be funneled in one direction and how we might be able to spread some of that out. I also saw that, now I don't know if we're getting money from other funds for the Multnomah County thing where there are 21 teachers for 51 clients.
21 staff,
I mean. And they may not be teachers, but certainly they're paid something. And you said that the ratio was 1-3. Is there any way that we, what I want to know tomorrow is there any way that these funds are fungible from one area to another area so we can beef up another area a little bit more where there seems to be such a need?
Madam Chairman, the answer to your question is no. So if they were fungible and transferable, I would have long ago done it. Okay?
Madam Chair.
Senator Yee.
I have a question kind of in the same line.
Okay.
Are we doing everything we can to make use of the 1-4 match, the $1 to $4 federal match?
Representative, Senator Yee, we are matching all of our, currently we're matching all of our federal appropriation. The last two legislatures saw the advantage of matching that full match of their federal. So we're matching all the federal funds that are available to us. The answer is yes, we are fully matching.
Mm-hmm. So here you talk about funds contributed by professional services organizations. Can those money be used for federal match also?
The answer is yes, and they are being used for match money.
And okay.
We're not matching totally with general fund dollars. We're also matching with other funds, and the other funds are sometimes these cooperative agreements we have with education and other sources.
Okay. And, Senator, I think what I think I'm going to do now, because we are getting a little bit more technical, and I do want to get the answers to those questions, so we will revisit this tomorrow.
Okay.
I think we all might have some questions, and we'd like to get them answered, and we thank you for your presentation today. And we will close, we will adjourn our meeting and reconvene tomorrow at 1 o'clock. John, did I cover it? Okay. And so we will begin with your agency tomorrow and then move to the director's office afterwards.
And I have the director's office.
Oh, okay.
For us to look at.
Tomorrow? No. The director? No.